Welcome. My name is Gilad Bernstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build the world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
I think the newer framing seems to be, what do these models currently enable, and are we actually okay with what they're enabling? And that's, I think, going to be a pretty big shift, because we have to sit and argue about what it's okay for them to do, what it's not okay for them to do. And I really hope that religious communities have a seat at the table when it comes to those discussions.
There is so much going on in the world of artificial intelligence that no matter how hard we try, it is impossible to keep up. And thus, we must rely on one another. To that end, I am thrilled to bring you another AI in the News and Current Events conversation with two new smart friends. So let's get started. Thank you guys for joining us today. I'm really grateful for you guys being a part of this conversation. It's really one of my favorites that we do a few times a year. But to kick things off, please tell us a bit about yourself and your areas of focus. And Marcus, we'll have you kick us off.
Sure. Thanks, Gilad, and thanks so much for having me. So my name is Dr. Marcus Schwording. I am a research scientist at the State University of New York in Buffalo, New York. My work focuses primarily on AI to apply to problems in chemistry and material science. I'm also the senior editor for AI and Faith.
Wonderful to have you. And Ben?
My name is Ben Christensen. My full name is Fleming Benjamin Christensen, and I use that to detail what I focus on. Cultural backgrounds matter in the age of AI. I live in New York. My wife is from Finland. We have three kids. I focus on building systems that help humans understand each other.
Wonderful. Those are both things that we need in our world, to understand each other. And I'm very excited about the opportunity to use AI to understand the physical world as well. Now, before we dive into all the specific topics we want to talk about today, I want to start the 10,000 foot view. There is so much going on in the world of artificial intelligence. What are a few things you're each paying attention to? And what are a few things that you think our AI and Faith community should be paying attention to? And Marcus, we'll have you kick us off again.
Sure. So I'm primarily working in the AI for science space recently, and there's been a lot of big developments there just in the last couple of months. So we've seen the major players, OpenAI and Anthropic, advertising more products to AI for scientists. We've also seen that a lot of scientific talent has been going more towards these companies, thinking specifically of someone like John Jumper from Google DeepMind, who recently switched over to Anthropic. And you're also starting to see some more differentiation amongst the labs as to the sorts of products that they're offering and tailoring to scientists. I think this will be something that will be important to consider as we look at the kinds of risks that may be associated with AI models helping scientists. So those are some of the things that I've been interested in. Another thing that I've found fascinating over the last few months is how much AI tools are now moving down the stack, as it were, from stuff that was primarily just conversational. Now it is making local commands, it is executing calls, it is interacting with APIs, and more than just agentic frameworks, it is becoming more integrated with the hardware on your local system and on other systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the point you just made there at the end, I think, is critical. You know, we're going from an AI, a generative AI era, where AI can communicate, to an agentic AI era, where AI can act. And that is a very big difference from where we were just a couple of years ago. Now, Ben, what are you paying attention to?
Building on down the stack, I would say culture and context. This is something I hear Anthropic CEO talking about more often, but also companies like Celonis. They're a decacorn in the AI world. They're focused on talking about how do we bring in more context. And then the other issue for the practitioners are, how can we put governance around that? Because it's this newly unstructured set of data, like different context layers as the next quantum leap. I shouldn't use quantum lightly because there's a quantum scientist on the call, Marcus.
Absolutely.
So I'll say context as the next leap of intelligence, or culture being the next leap of intelligence. That's what I'm hearing. And how to instrument that and then solve the AI governance challenges is something that I find new, where I see folks in charge of this at large enterprises. And having that discussion is exciting and fascinating because it brings the full spectrum of human identity into focus, not just who's involved. and the multi-dimensions of who those humans are, but how do you trust which of those are actually humans in a world where there's AI agents and human agents that can now work with your name, image, and likeness? And who authorizes that? So verification.
Absolutely. That is also something that comes up a lot in my professional lives as businesses ask themselves the question of, do they have an obligation to disclose where AI is being utilized? And even more so, do they have an obligation to disclose when the customer, the human customer, is interacting with a human versus interacting with a non-human entity? And that's been a conversation that come up a lot. In your work, Ben, or in your travels, how do you think about that question of kind of AI demasking?
Building at the speed of trust is a different speed of building than building at the speed of technology.
Yeah.
We often look at AI or any nascent technology, and it's building at the speed of the physics of light, frankly. Building at the speed of trust is slower or faster than the speed of technology, depending on the quality of that trust between people. Trust usually can seem to slow things down, but I've learned that computer science is functionally a social science. In my opinion, I know that's a hot topic because we have some really deep professionals here. I'd love to take that debate. But for me, there's a human at the end of every system and process, or at least there was until the roaring 2020s. But even so, that's what I find interesting. So the same similar physics that you have between humans, similar physics I propose exploring between non-humans and non-humans, non-humans.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things, right, where it used to be the hard part was the technology, but now the hard part's the people. And you know, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, always says in all of his speeches that the humans are the hard part of AI adoption because of all the things we need to balance to get it right. Now, one more thing that I'm sure many of our audience have been paying attention to is Mythos, which is the latest model from Anthropic, is back. I believe it was released again this week into the wild. So Marcus, maybe tell us a tiny bit about what's been the whole discussion around Mythos.
Sure. Backing up just a little bit. So Mythos was discussed behind closed doors several months ago, and the release of the model card indicated that Mythos was capable of executing a number of different cyber attacks and exploiting a number of cyber vulnerabilities. They published some of those alongside patches and then started Operation Glasswing to bring in industry professionals to help patch particularly cyber infrastructure in the banking sector, but in other areas as well. You know, that's something that had been sort of going on in the background already, where we were starting to see large language models having greater impetus in identifying vulnerabilities in 0 days. And that was something that I think we will maybe come back to CBR and Uplift later on, but that's something that concerned a lot of folks. And so the release of Fable was, I think, a bit surprising, Fable being the first Mythos class model released to the public with very, very heavy guardrails. So I was able to start using Fable and, you know, things that were just a little bit about chemistry or proteomics that I was looking at. It was like, oh no, that's too close to biology and to toxicology, and so we can't do that. And so it was interesting to see how strict the guardrails were. And then a number of folks found vulnerabilities and it was taken down. And now those vulnerabilities have been patched. And I know a little bit about those vulnerabilities, but you know, I suspect that more will continue to arise. So that's kind of where we're at. It's out there now.
He mentioned chemicals, and Carl Jung would have something to say here. The meeting of two people, personalities, is like the contact of two chemicals. If there's any reaction, both are changed, according to Carl Jung. To me, that means when I interact with you, Gilad, and Marcus in any way, and if it's anything but inert, I come away a different person. And probably you do too, because of our unique identities. And a different dimension of who I am illuminates because of the way that you resonate. So I come away usually with a reason to thank you for the new version of who I am. But if that's true, then I'm also thinking of it in terms of when I use an AI, when I interact with the newly released Fable model, I'm accustomed to being shaped by it as well as it learning from my prompts, unless I do a lot of tooling in the background to make sure that it's not retaining anything. So I think Carl Jung's observation applies to humans and AI as well. And I think that's very important. Society shapes technology, which shapes society. That should apply here to some extent. What happens is, if I'm borrowing from the field of computer-supported collaborative work, Dave Randall wrote a book called Fieldwork for Design, where he observed that the ecosystem of artifacts in an environment, in a workplace, in an air traffic control tower, for example, invites the persons who are there to act in certain and think in certain ways. So it is with when you have a new air traffic control tower or a Fable Mythos class model, you think differently because of what you think it's capable of. It draws out a different part of you for fear, for love, for better or worse. So I think those are important to reflect on how we're being shaped and shaping the models which we're using.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I often talk about how the least discussed element of AI's impact on our world, what I call the great commoditization, is the fact that every human that's ever lived has lived in a world dominated by human ideas. And we will soon live in a world where, by sheer number, there'll be many more non-human ideas than human ideas. And even if we get all the good stuff, right, the cancers are cured and productivity is through the roof and all those great things, we will still live in a world that is fundamentally different from the one we have today. Now, I want to dive into a few of the topics that I know are near and dear to your hearts and to your intellects, and really have spent a few minutes with each of them, helping our audience understand both where we are in these conversations, but also how they can participate, bringing positive momentum to these conversations. So the first one is all around AI discrimination. And Ben, we're hoping you can set the table for us a little bit. Like, where are we? What are the key areas we should be considering within that realm? And what advice do you have for other people trying to build a world where AI benefits all of us?
AI is known as a mirror for what it can get. One of my favorite descriptions of a generative AI is it turns the world into numbers and then does math on those numbers and does pattern recognition on those numbers when provoked by a question by a human or now an AI agent. So questions provoke knowledge into existence, which I think is the same thing that applies to science and us, you asking these great questions. Anti-discrimination, we're more, they won't be neutral. AI, the way that I'm looking at it, and when I was at SAP, I was there for 11 years, I came to realize that we needed to prevent the inadvertent development of weapons of mass discrimination because, from a de-risking a supply chain perspective, they could be used to profile folks and create discrimination as a service through CCTV on certain ethnic profiles. That, without naming or shaming, can be found by a search on where that's happened. But to focus on the opportunities here, anything that provokes or encourages greater curiosity or question intelligence by humans about themselves and each other and the different dimensions of who we are can be a good thing because it can bring hidden truths to light. And in the age of AI, we talk a lot about hallucinations. I believe false facts may be dangerous, but it's the hidden truths that are more sinister, where disinformation is used not just as a bullet, it's a bioweapon. And if we use the medical terminology, an immune response can be enhanced when you bring more cultural intelligence, that is, the hidden truths about the communities that we're already in that are kept hidden because of the virus of incuriosity, I like to call. That is, we're often so easily entertained in the age of AI or back in social media, wherever it was, that we failed even the well-intentioned to ask enough questions before we resort to condemnation or summary classification.
Absolutely. And before we bring Marcus into this piece of the conversation, when you speak with people throughout our world, throughout our community, what advice do you have? How do we work to make this better?
Ask better questions. Sounds simple, but it comes down to the prompting world has come back to the prompting of AIs has helped people. Oh, prompt engineering. Well, if you just took it from people to people, that helps me realize I need to ask better questions around the people around me and myself. So there's that. But then in the age of AI, your voice counts twice. So my best advice that I'm giving folks, and I shared this with the special advisor for the prevention of genocide for the UN this week, was in the age of AI, your voice counts twice. Once for the people that you mean to reach, especially your published voice, and twice for the machines that can now learn on whatever you've put out there as the mirror. For anyone who's not using their voice or not making themselves heard on Reddit or Substack, I'm not trying to create or encourage more noise, but engage your voice while you still have it and while it's still free to use. Tomorrow we'll be celebrating. I mean, this month we're celebrating a milestone of religious freedom. And use it while you can. It's also a freedom of expression. It counts twice at least. That's just the number I use, if not
Yeah.
more, in the age of AI.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Marcus, how do you think about AI discrimination and bringing a bit of a technical view to it? What can we do on the technology side to try to reduce that?
Sure, absolutely. Before getting to discrimination, one thing that I've been fascinated with is AI and misinformation and some of the work that has gone in recently to identifying and flagging the dissemination of misinformation. And it turns out that misinformation spreads differently than other types of information on the internet. And when you can identify how that spread occurs, what that network looks like over time, you can actually start to flag what is suspicious activity without even looking at the text itself. You're just looking at the spread. I think that's a really interesting avenue for research and exploration that doesn't even involve looking at the text and making some sort of qualitative assessment about it. So I've been really excited by that.
Absolutely. Sounds really
On
cool.
the, yeah, on the discrimination side, I think that a couple of years ago, a lot of the adjustments that were being made seemed somewhat ham-fisted, thinking of, for example, the Google Gemini faux pas with different individuals depicted in inappropriate ways. I think that now we have operationalized a lot of these sorts of outcomes across the major platforms. There's definitely a maturation in those safety standards, at least internally. Externally, it's still relying on a lot of just publicly available benchmarks.
Yeah.
And I've been interested in sort of developing some of those, particularly for religious communities. One area that I think still needs a lot of work, and I think the labs are probably working on this a lot internally, but there is a big gap in what we know about how large language models perform on languages other than English and Mandarin. So within the MMLU, the Massive Multi-Language Understanding benchmark, there are 13 languages, I believe, that are benchmarked. That's it. And that's the standard that everyone is using for benchmark evaluations. So we don't have an authoritative understanding of how LLMs perform in Korean. We don't have that for Swahili. We don't have it for Tamil. There are probably hundreds of millions of speakers whose native languages are not being supported or tested or assessed with large language models. And I think what we're starting to see is those language communities see that not only is their language not being reflected by these models, but their culture isn't either.
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of grassroots efforts to have large language models that are specifically tailored for language communities, which I think is wonderful. But so long as the gravitational pull will go towards those large players, I think it's really important that those large players pay attention to languages other than English and Chinese, and cultures that are different from what the training data consists of.
And how do you think about religious leaders or religious people who are trying to train models on specific texts, specific wisdoms within their own faith? Is that something you've seen succeed so far? Is that something that's prone to hallucinations? What have you seen?
Sure. So I think early days, so like early 2023, you were seeing a lot more hallucinations, and then like mid 2023, you saw retrieval augmented generation come into favor. And a lot of the tools that were being developed for religious communities were dependent on RAG. That's still the case. Many of the most popular platforms are using RAG with some sort of in-context prompting for a particular religious affiliation. I think that that's helpful and has certainly reduced erroneous behavior, but I worry that we're not necessarily doing a great job of assessing
Yeah.
those improvements and quantifying those gains. And actually, with a group of folks at AI and Faith, we're looking to submit a paper in early August to peer review an AI journal specifically on this topic. So, more on that maybe in the next month or so.
That's incredible. And Ben?
Fascinating, actually. I want to follow up with you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where I think it's really important for adherents of different faiths. You know, because of course, even within Christianity or within Judaism, there are different interpretations and different views. And helping people of faith understand the AI they're using, what it was trained on, where it comes from, I think is as critical as the training itself. So you know if this is really reflecting your own faith traditions or something else.
You know, one thing I think has been really interesting too is to see who are primarily creating the benchmarks. So there are quite a few different Muslim benchmarks. There are benchmarks for Jewish faith. There's benchmarks for Hindu faith. There are a couple for Christian faith. And to be frank, I have some challenges with those. We're trying to do better within AI and faith. But what I suspect is happening is a lot of people are using AI models who are Christians and going like, it's close enough, right? Like it's fine, right? So long as I don't ask it, is it pre-trib or post-trib or, you know, something nitty-gritty. But for somebody who is maybe a Muslim living in Morocco and is communicating with it in their native language, the gaps show up almost immediately. And so those are the communities that are like, okay, we actually need to build benchmark assessments and understand which models are actually doing best for us and have at least like a diagnostic before we start talking about fine-tuning and building our own infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. We see this a lot within the Orthodox Jewish community, where different sections of the Orthodox Jewish community have different interpretations of the law. And one easy example is kashrut, the dietary laws the Jewish people follow. And one question that people might ask is, after eating this meal that has meat or dairy in it, how long can I can eat the next meal that has the opposite? If there was dairy in the first one, meat in the second one, or vice versa. And the problem is, or the reality is different sects have different interpretations for how that works. So if you're going to ask an AI, and people do this already, like you take a picture of your plate and you ask AI to estimate calories, to estimate allergens, or if you're a religious person, to figure out if this is something that you're allowed to eat according to your faith. And what it's specifically trained on is going to be completely dependent on what the output is. So I think this whole conversation is really important. Now, before we move to the next topic, I want to bring Ben into this one more time. And also, I'm hoping you can go one level deeper for us on the disinformation as a bioweapon. Disinformation is something that I think we know is bad for the individual, but maybe share why you think it's kind of bad for the community or the society as a whole.
Disinformation can be weaponized for when you want to erase inadvertently or on accident a cultural memory or heritage. That putting disinformation out there, every fact or factoid has its own gravity, if I'm to borrow, and it becomes a social fact once a slander, libel, or bit of disinformation is there, and it needs to be dealt with. I mean, it's there. It can accumulate just like anything else that has mass or gravity, except it doesn't have mass in the same sense. So I'm looking at it from that perspective, but because it can live rent-free, especially perhaps on those how misinformation spreads differently, I'm not sure the way that you were mentioning it, but some things live rent-free when they're interesting or cringy enough, whether they're true or not in people's minds. And so they can it lives and occupies space. Almost cancerously, those can be calculated to do so, and they are being used in some cases when there's disputes over whose cultural heritage precedes whose other on certain pieces of land. Therefore, it moves organizations to, well, it moves me. I'm the only person I can really speak for, because I've never been anyone other than myself. Is it moves me to want to bolster and to. Oh, wait, I know that that particular cultural attribute exists, and I wouldn't want that to be misrepresented. But when it comes to the European Commission, for example, that's actually cultural intelligence as a national infrastructure or an international infrastructure can be bolstered the same way you would try to treat an illness or an epidemic of distributed disinformation, whether it's deliberate or happenstance. And so I looked at that, but I got really excited about assessing benchmarks. And I wanted to ask, how do you trust, after what you said, Gilad, as well, how do you trust what data that you're getting, what information you're getting when you're getting into the minutiae of those things, if you're prompting a non-human agent that's been built in your language or in your grassroots community? How do you trust is always the question. And that's another topic is verifiability.
And this is where I think AI auditability becomes incredibly important, both within the realms we're talking about today, but also within the normal business realm. When someone's trying to sell you a customer service AI bot, How do you know if it's actually good at performing customer service for your customers? So ultimately, I think this AI auditability piece you're talking about is incredibly important in many realms of life and society.
Auditability, I put that in on one of the pillars of responsible AI.
Yeah.
I represent a nonprofit called AI 2030, which is to mainstream six pillars of responsible AI: fairness, accountability, transparency, safety, security, sustainability. Those are the same words that are used to describe the quality of religious freedom in countries and communities as well, I found. So those can be an API to each other's worlds.
Absolutely.
There's a company called Cultural Infusion Atlas that I work with often, and they produce research. They've done 500,000 surveys in 40 countries over the last 5 years. And fun fact, one of the things they found is 700 trillion, trillion, trillion unique combinations of human identity. That's an insane number. And it shouldn't surprise anybody that we're as unique as what could be called a fingerprint, although fingerprints, I believe, have more recently been debunked. They're not that unique as we thought. But the idea stands. And so the question I put in the way of trust verification, there's no IEEE standard for human identity. And there probably shouldn't be, because we're not technologies. And the IEEE is standards for technologies. But in the age of, and I think you hit it already, Gilad, that we're in, there's 8.2 billion people on the planet, but there's perhaps 9 billion persons, depending on how you define personhood, when where proof of personhood comes in terms of AI agents or non-human coworkers that are functionally, that is to say, how do you vet the AI agents coming at you from your municipalities and corporations with some sort of, whether it's customer service or your religious community? And then how do you scope your terms on how your own data, name, image, likeness, whatever, how that goes and gets carried and gets authorized by your AI approximation of yourself, which you may have agentified with others. And that comes down to these proof of control and verification processes, which a group that I advise called the Advanced AI Society are all about that, this centralized verification. And that's something that is a set of research that is worth looking into.
Absolutely. And you touched on a few really important topics there that we'll have to return to another day, but the idea of human agency, human authorship, and then also human responsibility, I think are critical elements as we begin to deploy more of these AI bots into the world. Now, I want to switch topics because one of the things that's been talked about a lot in the world, and our longtime listeners of the podcast will remember we did a couple episodes about this last year, is CBRN uplift and the concept of dual use technologies. So Marcus, please start us off with kind of the basics. Help us define this whole ecosystem, what's included within, help us understand it.
Sure. So CBRN, to start with, stands for chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. And it is a collection of existential level threats that could arise from pretty much anywhere, right? So these were first proposed in, I believe, 2017. So the same year as Attention Is All You Need and Vaswani et al. People have been thinking about this longer than we've had large language models in late 2022, right? Of where these existential threats come from and how they ought to be measured. And I think the easiest way to conceptualize it is, can I put a tool in the average person's hands and they would be capable of carrying out chemical, biological warfare? Are they able to build a bomb? And, you know, the first instance of people sort of interrogating this was like, well, can I actually just use Google? And can I figure this out just with the tools that we have on hand through our interconnected internet? And then, of course, that got co-opted when we saw large language models coming to the fore and actually starting to build benchmarks associated with each of those dimensions, identifying the ways where we see uplift, i.e. the average Joe wasn't able to do a whole lot to begin with, now they're able to do more. Let's measure how much more they would have been capable of. Around that time, you also saw cybersecurity as an axis that people added to CBRN. I guess CCBRN didn't quite roll off the tongue as well, but that has since become the area where Mythos, for example, has yielded the most progress. So as we're looking across these now five axes, we're seeing that uplift is starting to become more of a concern. Cyber, obviously, but there are a lot more concerns around biological and chemical warfare being enabled by these sorts of tools. This isn't the kind of thing that a regulatory environment seems quite ready to address. I think that's a really important challenge that religious communities can start to address and advocate for. And sort of building on what Ben was saying earlier around misinformation, one thing I've been interested in is what does a religious uplift dimension look like? What does a sociocultural dimension to CBRN look like? If we were to add to that definition, could we construct a benchmark around cult-like behavior or the dissemination of misinformation or bad actors who are trying to use this to sway political sentiment, right? I think that's going to be an important part of CBRN, and CBRN is already taken very seriously by the Frontier Labs. If we can sort of add another dimension to that definition, I think they would take that very seriously. And so that's something that I've been thinking about with Anthropic Fable, but just more generally within these regulatory frameworks where, even a year ago, it was all about IP export controls and what do we do about GPU clusters? And now it's like sort of using cryptography as the basis and, knowing how well that worked out to say like, oh, you can't export cryptography. It's like, well, once the math is out, it's out. So I think the newer framing seems to be, what do these models currently enable? And are we actually okay with what they're enabling? And that's, I think, going to be a pretty big shift because we have to sit and argue about what it's okay for them to do, what it's not okay for them to do. And I really hope that religious communities have a seat at the table when it comes to those discussions.
Absolutely. And of course, that is one of the key missions that we have here at AI and Faith, is to make sure that people of all faith backgrounds and traditions have a seat at the table. Ben, how do you think about this whole ecosystem?
I'm optimistic that benchmarks are in process because of groups like AI and Faith, but others as well. Turning anthro data into cultural intelligence for socioeconomic value, innovation, not just prevention of discrimination in the AI era, is a great opportunity. The more we can do to create a data platform for understanding humanity, the better. These are ideas that I'm deeply influenced by. The atlas that is produced by Cultural Infusion, once again. Because once I see it, I can't unsee it. The foundational data, one of the biggest questions, we go back to building at the speed of trust. And I saw this when I was at SAP, and their AI ethics community wanted to include the wisdom of the world's religions, or they welcomed that intervention. And the result was they wanted more. I saw, in order to become known as the trusted or the most resilient AI product for whatever industry, which is often the goal or a mission, how do you benchmark that? Well, how do you measure that? It's like, well, we have more depths of understanding, or we have a deeper data set. AI is only as good as data that it's trained on. But you, Marcus, have pointed to some important areas of opportunity to develop benchmarks to make sense of the new areas of context of culture that have previously gone untapped, ignored, or just nice to have, or even weird to have, frankly, which is what I found when I founded the Interfaith Alliance at SAP. It was weird to have before it was nice to have. And then it became strategic to have when it gave a functional framework and toolkit for both executives and employees alike to have clumsy conversations about each other's religions. There was not just a safe space, but a brave space for that. That finds its way into customer value. That finds its way into more resilient products, even if you're not creating a search engine like Bing and searching for, show me images related to Judaism. What comes up first? Are they images laced with some tinge of discrimination? And who vets that? These are important things to encourage trust, not just from customers, but internally, let alone the stakeholders of all kinds. I'm really encouraged by the opportunity, but it's not a neutral thing, and it tends to skew negative. That is to say, without intervention, without a conscientious flexing of the muscle of democracy, if I may so call it, or a civic duty of folks talking about this or at asking questions, there must be an entropy law where we just understand each other less. And we get each other wrong. Misunderstandings will happen wherever there's a human, but it's the flowing of a river. How long can rolling waters remain impure is a line from the cultural world of my my religious background. And so the waters of, or as Goethe would say, a man sees in the world what he carries in his heart. If that's an AI model, then it's an AI sees in the world what it carries in its heart. And you know, I don't have the most accurate information about you or your faiths, you know, whoever I meet. And I'll have disinformation, but if we can keep rolling and I don't just, you know, calcify that into some sort of a rock somewhere, maybe we can just keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to ask you one more question, Marcus, or kind of a two-sided question here about this topic. So one is, I'm hoping you can redefine the concept of dual-use technology for us. This is something that some of our listeners will remember from past conversations about technology that's coming from the military and other parts of our space. And the second part of the question is, bringing your own faith tradition into it, how do you think about technologies that have multiple use cases? Some of them that may be incredibly valuable and beneficial to society, and some of them that can be used elsewhere. You know, in our conversation about specifically AI in war and AI in the military, we talked about a knife, and a knife can be used for surgery to heal someone. A knife can be used to make food to feed someone, and of course, a knife can be used to do really bad things to people as well. Help us understand what is dual use, or at least remind us, and then how do you think about that difficult balancing act?
Yeah, I do have some experience in that area. There was an instance just about 3 years into my PhD where a couple of years prior, I had published some code in a GitHub repo with a paper. The paper was peer-reviewed and accepted, and it was about ways that GPUs could be used in sort of creatively to look at image scenes and just very rapidly make control decisions. And we were using it for predictions of flame spray and like ultimately to try and design better fuels and stuff like that. And it was just a really neat project. And I learned a lot from it. And the science was interesting. Then a couple of years later, about the third year of my PhD, I run into somebody who works for a US-based defense contractor. And they said, we all know about this paper and are using it, and you know the code is there, and knowing what their industry does, and it was not at all hard to s just think like, oh, wait a second, that's how they're using the code on a device to do like control theory in real time, and it was just really uncomfortable. For me, it actually it kind of made me physically ill at the time. So that was one instance. Another instance that comes to mind is I do a lot of AI models for chemistry. And the typical framing of the problem is, hey, we're using this chemical in this manufacturing process. It has to satisfy a whole list of properties and attributes. And the one we're using right now is really toxic. We don't like it for these reasons. Can you find a better alternative? And so it's like, okay, I will try and predict those properties. I'll go through in the literature and see what we can find and what the AI can identify and like try and point to some better alternatives. And that's a really effective way of tackling these sorts of problems. This was, again, like 2 or 3 years ago, I built a toxicity prediction model associated with that. And the point was, it was a part of this broader infrastructure to identify less toxic alternatives for chemicals and manufacturing processes. And
Incredible.
yeah, so I'm talking to my wife one day and I tell her about the toxicity one. And she's like, well, if you can design chemicals that minimize toxicity, couldn't you just like do it to maximize toxicity? And sure enough, I had never thought of that. I went to my computer and I literally just flipped a negative sign to a positive sign and reran the thing. And suddenly I'm seeing all of these chemicals that look like, you know, neurotoxins and Novichok and all this kind of stuff. And it's predicted to be more toxic. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is in a GitHub repository. I need to like figure out what to do about this. And so the dual use problem is one that I have just tried to be a lot more creative in thinking through how the things that I'm building affect other people. And that's kind of the best advice I can give at this point is like, Just if you're developing tools like that, just be creative. Just try and think. Red team your own stuff and imagine how a bad actor could use this.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing those two personal examples with us. These are both some of the best real-world examples I've heard of this example of dual-use technology. And I'm just really grateful they were willing to share both of those things with us. And I think what you said just there about red teaming, and just to define it for any of our audience who doesn't know what red teaming is, it's you putting on the bad guy hat and saying, if I was really malicious, what could I do with this technology? I think it's very important for all of us putting new capabilities into the world to be creative in maybe the negative way. We hope other people would not be creative.
I just quickly add to that. I think it is very easy to be working on a problem and sort of dissociate from the real world
Yes.
consequences and focus on the statistics and the math and the cool, cyber infrastructure you're building. And it can genuinely just be really hard to be talking about, maximizing a number and making changes to maximize that number, and then thinking about like what is everything that's actually condensed within that number. And you are so far away from, the recommender system that's pushing somebody towards negative outcomes. You don't get to see that, but all you see is the number. All you
Yeah.
see is like a math problem. And that's what you're optimized for. So like I want to challenge folks who our developers and are making important decisions about infrastructure, about machine learning models, just about development in general. These have moral consequences, and you need to think hard and long about what those consequences could be and how those affect the tools you build.
Marcus, that was incredible. And I just made a decision on the fly that I hope it's okay with you guys, that the three of us are going to record another episode together here soon. There's a number of topics that I would like to go into in further detail, and this is, of course, one of those topics. As again, I think your examples just illustrate the types of things that a lot of us will be facing in our lives and we're going to have to think through over the coming years. And then, of course, in the next conversation, we're going to spend a lot more time with the topic we spoke about at the beginning around the future of human intelligence. And there's this concept that Ben brought into the conversation. He slid it in earlier, but I want to spend more time really unpacking it around curiosity and cultural intelligence as a social infrastructure. But before I let you guys go, I do want to ask you two questions about what you're hearing out there in the wild. What are other people talking about in terms of current events and important topics? So, Marcus, we're going to start with you. And as you shared earlier, you're the senior editor here at AI and Faith. So you get lots of letters and maybe even phone calls from our members and our community. What are they asking you about and what are they thinking about?
Yeah, a lot of folks thinking about the encyclical lately, a lot of folks interacting and responding to it, so which has been really great. And I think a lot more people who are reaching out who aren't a part of the organization saying, I haven't really thought about what my faith has to do with AI, but now it seems to be an important topic. And I'm now thinking about that and would like to help or would like to learn more. So that's been really encouraging.
I love that. And I love that people are trying to bring their own faith, their own ethics into these AI conversations. It is clearly what we all need to be doing in this world. And Ben, similar question to you. You speak at all sorts of organizations and you work specifically with companies and with clients out there. What are they asking you about? What are they concerned or thinking about?
I see companies grappling with what context to choose when they're taking the next level of intelligence on their AI models. And
Oh, wow.
one will have 6 layers of context, one will have 9 layers, but they're choosing those. And classifications have consequences. One of my favorite books by Boker and Starr from MIT Press, Sorting Things Out, Classifications and Their Consequences, has made me look at the world differently. And when you're choosing contexts, and which context will be included and excluded, whether that's vendor materials or regional sensibilities or just a set of documents or the actual nuances of demographics of the people that your customers live among, that your customers identify as, or the people in your workplace, what time they're going to be choosing to celebrate their high holy holiday. In some cases, that's a context they have to choose, even a large enterprise, whether or not to include. Often you're measuring processes, but there's people there that affect how those go. So that's an interesting thing. And then there's a whole AI governance around that. So that, okay, how to grapple with contexts,
Yep.
as well as A lot of folks just want to ship, scale, and they want an AI strategy. So my partner Gold and I run an AI strategy and implementation consultancy, and a lot of folks want to convert their businesses into smarter AI businesses. What really is, they just need cleaner data. They just need some automation, right? It's like you don't really need AI for this, and it will be expensive, and the tokens will be burning. And on that point, Marcus's dire and vital call to Red Team, what you're building is, I would say, he recommended we all have a long and deep, for those who are building things. That's expensive. That takes tokens of human attention, let alone tokens of the whatever you're subscribing to. And a lot of folks are just trying to figure out how, in the surge of increased AI work that you have to do because you're trying to make sense of all these tools and to ship anything and get it out there. And then they ask us for help to scale it, or that's the last thing they're going to want to spend more time on. So getting more people to think responsible AI is actually strategic, resilient, competitive, profitable, sustainable, not just AI for because you could do it sake.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this thoughtfulness and the impact that AI has on our world is profound, which is both why this conversation is so wonderful and why I'm so grateful to have both of you as friends and as community members in this effort to bring AI into the world in a way that's pro-human and pro-humanity. Now, before I let you go, and we will have you back sometime later this summer, I do have three lightning round questions, 15 seconds apiece, and Ben, you're going to kick us off. So your first question is, what is one place you're excited to travel to this summer?
I would like to travel to Greenland. I've been fascinated with extremes in weather, especially watching Christina Koch go to the moon, I mean, beyond the moon earlier this year. And I read her background, and it was, she's just been an adventurer, Antarctica, all these crazy places. And I'm also a Danish citizen, and I'm really excited about, I've never been to Greenland. My wife's from Finland. I love extreme temperatures as an expeditionary
Yeah.
experience, but I'm really fascinated at that. So I'm not going there this summer because I have three kids. The
Yeah.
places that I'm going are going to be emotional, spiritual distances, but not physical distances.
I get that. And Marcus, what are you excited about visiting this summer?
So we actually, this past Monday, got back from a trip to France. We had not been to the continent before, even though we're currently in the UK. Talking about extreme temperatures, Ben, I believe it hit
Oh.
107 in Paris when we were
Yeah.
there. It was a record heat wave, but we saw Paris, we saw Normandy in Bayeux, we saw Mont Saint-Michel, we were in the lavender fields of Provence, we saw Tours in
Beautiful.
Nice. It was a really wonderful experience. So that was our big summer trip.
That is wonderful. All right, Marcus, you're going to go first on this next one. What is a recent book or essay you read that you would recommend to others?
Yeah, so my wife's favorite book is called In This House of Breed by Rumer Godden, and it is one that I just read for the first time. And it is a pretty, it's just a wonderful book if you like. I went to a Catholic school growing up. I had nuns for teachers. The book is about a group of cloistered nuns who are just living faithfully and are stewarding resources and are having just living life together. And it
Yeah.
was one a wonderful book, so I highly recommend.
Outstanding. And Ben?
Dawn by Octavia Butler. It's a science fiction classic, and moral imagination, as Marcus introduced earlier, is vital in the age of AI because we're very much living a lot of these. And science fiction was a, there's a methodology I co-authored when I was at SAP to help companies imagine the implications of these. But Dawn is about a lady who wakes up in a future where Earth has to be recultivated before it can be repopulated, and humans themselves have to be recultivated. And the only ways that fertility can be reclaimed is by modifications made by merging with the alien occupying species that has rescued the remnants of the humans. Highly controversial, highly relevant when you consider Carl Jung's, we change each other when we interact. And it just may be that we may need to, well, I don't know if we need to change each other in order to save ourselves from impending destruction, but we may not be able to do it by being who we are today.
And my guess is probably some relevance to AI as well, in the way that some people are imagining merging our intelligence and our maybe even physical bodies with AI. Final question, and I think Ben, you're going to kick us off. What is one of your favorite personal AI use cases? Something small that you do regularly that you think is just a great AI use case?
My wife is a Finnish pop star, and because of that, large language models have learned a little bit about what her music and tone is like. So I often enjoy, write something in the way that Yona would write it. Can you write an extra lyric to a verse in the lyrics that Yona would do? And that's really kind of fun to play with to see, oh, how wrong they got that, or how fun and how interesting that they kind of got that one pretty well. And that's a new little bit.
That is
Terrifying.
awesome. And Marcus?
So a few weeks ago, I was talking to a colleague who she was about to publish her monograph, and her publisher asked her to put together an index. And she was dreading having to spend the next 8 hours combing through her textbook looking for all of the index terms. So I offered to just put it through an LLM and chunk it and have the page numbers all aggregated. And it worked quite well. You know, it turned an 8 hour job into something like a 2 hour job, which was
Amazing.
great. And you know, it's just a lot of effort of looking through and checking that was avoided. So I am looking towards publishing my own monograph on machine learning for spectroscopy. And just last week, I sort of got everything into a state where I was ready to start putting together the index. And I had an LLM go through the book and do the initial draft of the index for me. And then I spent a few hours adjusting it, and I'm quite pleased with that. So saving time and doing something that didn't really want to have to deal with. So there you go.
Absolutely. My latest one is my 3-year-old's really into connect the dot drawings. And I found that the books we were getting were kind of boring. So I used AI to create a bunch of connect the dot drawings of places we've been to on our trips and our adventures.
That's
Now,
cool.
absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. Thank you so much for the work you do in the world and for the positivity you put out there. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and faith community for joining us for another conversation. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.